Citizens of Israel might be forgiven for feeling like they're stuck in a very strange and very unpleasant form of Groundhog Day. For the fifth time, that's right, the fifth time since 2019, Israel is headed for new elections this fall. How did it happen? Why did it happen? Why is Israel's political system like this? And what's going to happen? We'll discuss it all in this episode. I'm Dr. Nolte, and this is Blind Politics. And welcome, podcast listeners, to another episode of Blind Politics with Dr. Nolte. Welcome also to our podcast viewers. Viewers, please forgive me for forgetting that you can see me. Number one, there's the obvious reason. And number two, I think we did like 150-some episodes where it was just audio, but now we're also visual, so you can see my face if you prefer that option. I am Dr. A.J. Nolte, Assistant Professor of Government at Regent University's Robertson School of Government. Once again, views expressed in this podcast do not represent those of either Regent University or the Robertson School. Please remember you can rate and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast provider. You can also find us through American One, on the App Store or on YouTube or on their website at American One. So Israel, once again, is faced with a political crisis, a vote of no confidence, the fall of their government, and new elections. This is the fifth time since 2019. How did we get here? Well, first of all, and this will be somewhat old news for those who've been longtime listeners of the podcast, but new for those of you who are new listeners, and we welcome you. And so I'm happy to talk about this. And if you have been listening for a long time, here's just a refresher on how much fun Israel's politics actually is. In the pre-state period, before Israel had become recognized as an independent country, there was a Zionist political organization called the Yeshuv. And the Yeshuv had a system that was very much focused on representation. There are many different factions within the Israeli Zionist movement, and so they wanted to create a system that was as representative as possible. And boy, is the Israeli system representative. Israel uses what is called list proportional representation system in one national district. Now, for those of you who aren't political science nerds, let me break that down for you. List proportional representation, or list PR, is a system in which each party chooses a certain number of candidates who are going to stand for the Knesset and be on its party list. There will, of course, be technically, I think 120 members of the Knesset or members of that list, but no party's ever gotten that many. And so really as high up on the list as you can be is where you want to be. Some parties do this through a primary system, some through just sort of, you know, if it's smaller parties, they'll just sort of choose a list of names, but they will submit these lists of people who are going to be chosen. And then when you go to vote in Israel, you vote for a party. The votes are then divided up by percentage of the vote. And if you're above a certain threshold, I believe it's right now 3.14%, then you get seats in the Knesset. The way it works out in practice is the threshold is high enough that you, if you're going to make it in at all, you're probably going to do so with about 4 seats, give or take. So it's very important then if your party to make it across the threshold to make sure that there's not votes that are wasted. Now, the upshot of this is that you have a lot of parties in the Israeli Knesset. And here's the catch. To form a government, you need a total of 61 out of 120 seats. No party has, in recent memory, gotten close to 60 seats. At one point, there was a party that had super majorities in Israel. It was the Israeli Labor Party, the party of David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister. And they would routinely get large percentages of the vote. Then for a while, there was a de facto two-party system between Likud and Labor, and they would sort of trade things back and forth. Now, however, there is extreme fragmentation as groups from the ultra-Orthodox to the Arabs have all entered into Israeli politics, fielded parties of their own, ran for the Knesset, and gained seats. As a result of which, Israel has an extremely diverse political system with an emphasis on extreme and diverse. So, what has caused the recent crisis? After all, with a political system like this, you might think they'd be having elections all the time, but for a long time that hasn't been the case. So what's been different since 2019? Well, the then Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, was facing the potential of indictment and had also been Prime Minister for a long time. If you are a young person in Israel, sort of under the age of 30, Netanyahu's been in politics your whole life and been prime minister for at least half of it. He has been around for a long time, having a stint in government in the 90s and then having served as prime minister for almost 15 years now, give or take. Bibi Netanyahu is an interesting figure. In the United States, he comes across as a very erudite, certainly conservative, but eloquent speaker of English, a figure who is very well known in American politics, and is seen as almost sort of the Ronald Reagan of Israel by many conservatives. In Hebrew, or in Israel, Bibi is known as a sharp-eyed, sharp-elbowed Machiavellian political operator, much more in the vein of Richard Nixon than Ronald Reagan. It would be hard to detail all of the Machiavellian maneuverings that Netanyahu has engaged in at different times in his career. But he has tried to merge parties, he has tried to unmerge parties, he has tried to run against the threat of the Arabs, he has tried to run in coalitions with an Arab party. So he has been very much a survivor and a sharp-elbowed and effective political operator. Unfortunately, when you have sharp elbows, you tend to leave a lot of bruises, and bruised egos in politics, especially in parliamentary politics, mean feuds, and feuds particularly on the right. If you were going to look at Israel in terms of the left-right spectrum, which is largely defined based on security issues more than anything else, the right in Israel would probably have a pretty clear, compelling, and convincing majority if they weren't divided by personalities. But those personal revisions or personal divisions run long and deep. The irony is that most of the people on the right who are running in parties that are not part of Likud and that are unwilling to work with Likud are people who actually were in Likud under Netanyahu before. Many of them were people who were hoping to eventually succeed Bibi when he turned out, only to realize the old lion was in no way, shape, or form ever going to give up power. Bibi is going to have to be dragged out of leadership of Likud at this point. Some of them feuded with Bibi, some feuded with his son, some feuded with his wife. And as a result, there are a number of ex-Likudniks who are running their own parties on the right and refusing to work with Netanyahu, come what may. All of this culminated in 2019, when one of Bibi's former acolytes, not a member of Likud, but someone who had been a close ally in the past, Avigdor Lieberman, essentially refused to support a measure of Bibi's government, causing a political crisis that resulted in elections. But Bibi was also facing indictments, which he claims are politically motivated, and his political opponents claim mean that he should be in jail. So the problem that Bibi faced then was that as long as he was prime minister, he couldn't go to jail. He couldn't really even be indicted or brought to trial. But the minute he was no longer prime minister, he could potentially be subject to legal action. Well, as you might imagine, he put a high priority on retaining the prime ministership. And while Bibi's Likud was the largest party in each election that they've had since then, it's been very difficult for him to form a stable coalition. In fact, while he's had coalitions at different times, none of them have been particularly stable. There hasn't been a coalition government in Israel that's had more than 63 or 64 votes in quite some time. Now, if Bibi's so unpopular, why can't his opponents form a coalition to oust him? Well, because the only thing they can agree on is that Bibi shouldn't be prime minister, which is seemingly good for forming a coalition government, but then you actually have to do things with it. Fast forward to last year, when Naftali Bennett, one of those former Likudniks who was a close ally of Bibi at one point, but eventually had a falling out, was able to cobble together the most remarkable coalition in the history of Israel. Naftali Bennett's party, Yamina, is to the right of Likud. In fact, one of the main things that Yamina formed to support was annexation of a large portion of the West Bank. Quite surprising then that Naftali Bennett would actually be able to form a coalition that included Ram. Ram is an Arab party, not just an Arab party, but an Islamic party that is explicitly based on Islamic values. In fact, they have a very distant link to the Muslim Brotherhood, although they've really become more of a socially conservative party that represents the Bedouins in the Israeli desert than a real affiliate of Muslim Brotherhood. Mansour Abbas, the head of Ram, shocked everybody when he said that he would be willing to go into a coalition with a Zionist party. But this shouldn't have been as shocking as it was, because that's essentially the route to participation in Israeli politics taken by the non-Zionist ultra-Orthodox in the past. So if you're following Israeli politics, that would be parties like Shas and UTJ. These are parties that initially didn't support the creation of the State of Israel, but have sort of warmed up to it over time and have fought for social conservatism and preservation of many of the benefits that the Orthodox receive from the Israeli government. That's a complicated story deserving of a podcast of its own that we don't really have time to delve into now. But Mansour Abbas seems to have looked at this deal and said, I want some of that. And to a certain extent, has gotten it. So Abbas went into coalition with Naftali Bennett, who is a very, very conservative figure, as well as some other conservative figures like Gideon Saar, another ex-Likudnik, Benny Gantz, who is sort of a center-to-center-right figure, former head of the IDF, Yair Lapid, who is a centrist figure leaning a little bit more toward the center-left, although he's economically fairly center-right, but certainly socially he would be center-left by Israeli standards, meaning that he opposes a lot of the benefits and Sabbath restrictions that the Orthodox like, and is supported by many of the more upscale secular elements. And then parties even further to the left, right? So parties like Labor and then Meretz, which is a Zionist party, but is about as far left as you can get and be still within the Zionist framework. Meretz actually has a decent amount of support from the Arab community as well, which has helped keep them in the Knesset. So this is a really odd coalition government with a very, very narrow majority, and it was perhaps unsurprising that it was going to fall at some point. In fact, Bibi Netanyahu has been biding his time, waiting for the moment when he could strike. And that moment came at a very, very bizarre juncture in Israel. So let me explain. There's a law that essentially says that in some of these settlements, the larger settlements that have been more well-established, that are somewhat less controversial at this point in terms of Israel and some of the legal aspects. Although all the settlements are controversial if you're coming at it from the Palestinian side, but just as a practical, realistic matter, these are some of the settlements that are well-established enough that they're kind of more facts on the ground. So we're not talking about some of the new settlements that folks are talking about building. Controversial, but not as controversial within Israeli politics. There was a law that was proposed that essentially said we are going to treat these settlements, the citizens in these Israeli settlements, under Israeli law. So they are what are called legal settlements. They are going to be governed by and subject to Israeli law, although they are technically in the West Bank. Mansour Abbas, for very understandable reasons, said, I'm not going to be able to vote for this bill. And Naftali Bennett thought, no problem. Ram has 4 seats, but he assumed there was no way that the parties on the right, the parties of the opposition, for Netanyahu and his closest allies, wouldn't vote to reauthorize that law. After all, they all support it. But Netanyahu saw his moment. If Ram didn't support that bill and Netanyahu withheld his consent, then Naftali Bennett wouldn't have the votes to pass the bill. At which point, the only way he could make sure that all the settlements didn't lose their legal status was to dissolve the Knesset, which would automatically extend the law for 6 months after the next election. So in a typical Machiavellian Netanyahu political maneuver, Bibi refused to extend the law that would have granted legal status to the settlements, something that he supported, knowing that Bennett would then be forced to dissolve the Knesset, triggering an election within the next 6 months. And that's exactly what Bennett was forced to do. Not only that, Bennett has also resigned as prime minister because due to the rotation agreement that he used to form his coalition, the other leader of that coalition, Yair Lapid, becomes interim prime minister. This was another reason why Bennett thought that Netanyahu probably wouldn't play games, because the idea of Lapid as prime minister scares Netanyahu's Orthodox allies more than almost any other figure who has a reasonable chance of being prime minister. Lapid has been adamant about his desire to remove some of the benefits for the Orthodox and possibly even change some of the Sabbath laws. And so he was something like enemy number one for much of the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel. Nevertheless, Bibi took the plunge, Bennett lost his majority, and has now said that he intends to resign from political life, and Israel is headed for yet another election. So what's going to happen? Well, that's anybody's guess. According to current polling, Netanyahu looks like he's going to lead the largest party again. But is it going to be large enough that he can form a coalition? Hard to say. There's also been preliminary announcement, and by the time this comes out, we may have more details on this, that Benny Gantz, the former general in the IDF, who was also Bibi's main sort of antagonist in the first couple rounds of these elections, and then also served briefly in a unity government during COVID, with Netanyahu. Benny Gantz has just formed a coalition with Gideon Saar. I mentioned him as a previous Likudnik. He challenged Bibi in a primary in one of these elections. I think it was not the most recent one, but the one before that. He challenged him actually within Likud, lost, and then formed his own party, which he called New Hope. It would be appropriate to make a Saar Wars joke if you were that type of person, which I am. And so Gantz and Saar apparently have formed some sort of coalition. And so there's going to be a lot more of this. There's a lot of coalition forming. There's a lot of new parties that emerge every time there's an Israeli election as people are trying to make it above the threshold and make sure that they are somehow in power. Here's the thing. The right without Bibi Netanyahu would be able to form a government very easily and very quickly. And it would probably be able to get a lot of stuff done. But Bibi Netanyahu has no interest in stepping down from power. And so he's going to run for it again. And he may even be able to reinstall himself as prime minister. But at some point, it's not going to last. I'm not going to be the one who predicts that this is going to be Bibi's political demise, because so far he's evaded every prediction along those lines that has come along. And the smart money is to say, this time's going to be no different. It's not clear that someone has emerged who can take him on and is going to be successful. But on the other hand, how long can he last? How many lives does the cat have? It's hard to say. Regardless of what happens, there are a couple of interesting things that we can take away from what's been happening in Israel. First, from the perspective of Mansour Abbas, there are certainly benefits for participating in government. And from the Israeli perspective, having Arab parties that are actually participating in government and willing to back governments is a benefit, even if there are concessions that have to be made. However, Abbas has also learned that there are limits to his effective ability to participate. Israeli potential prime ministers in the future have learned there are certain points beyond which they can't really push their Arab allies. So you can have an Arab party in the coalition if you genuinely have margin. Another thing that is interesting to watch in these elections is the percentage of the vote that the rest of the Arab parties, what's called the Joint Arab List, gets. These are the more traditional secular Arab nationalist parties that would more closely identify with the Palestinian cause, and they tend to be less focused on some of the religious values. Do their vote shares decline, and does Ram hold up its margin, stay in parliament, and do we also see Arab citizens of Israel voting for Meretz or even some of the other parties that are maybe not as far to the left? That could happen as well. So that's something to watch. Another thing that will be interesting to keep an eye on is what party mergers end up happening, which parties end up running together on a joint list to make sure that they are able to be in the Knesset. There's always a couple, and there's always some that are really surprising. My favorite merger was a merger of a fairly conservative, orthodox, or traditionalist, not conservative in the conservative Jewish sense, but conservative in the sense of fairly traditional orthodox rabbi and his political movement, with one of the pro-cannabis legalization parties that happened a couple of elections ago. It was a party called Zehut. Unfortunately, they did not make it across the threshold because the combination of orthodox rabbis and cannabis legalization advocates would be a fascinating party in the Knesset, but it did not happen, sadly. But there might not be one that is quite that interesting, but there will be some interesting party mergers to watch. Finally, one thing to keep in mind if you're an election watcher, particularly if you're someone who likes to play a little bit on something like Predictit or other election betting websites, because election betting is a thing, the juiciest thing to watch is not necessarily just the election itself. We will probably have a reasonable sense of where the parties are going to come out, who's going to pass the threshold and who's not, and all that sort of thing, in the weeks running up to the election. No, where things get really crazy is after the election, in terms of government formation. So normally you're watching an election and you're like, oh, the election returns are in, the results are in, you know, the election is over and we now know the outcome. No, not so fast when we're talking about Israel, because there's another month of government formation that has to happen after that. And if they can't form a government, you guessed it, sixth election is on the horizon. So lots to watch here in terms of Israel. From the U.S. perspective, I doubt much is going to change. There are very few parties in Israel, for example, who don't have in foreign policy a strong commitment to the idea that Iran should not have a nuclear weapon, a strong commitment to the Abraham Accords, and a strong commitment to the U.S. alliance. So it's not like this is going to hugely affect our relationship with Israel. It may from an interpersonal perspective, in the sense that if Netanyahu comes back, I don't get the impression that he and Biden get on very well together. Whereas if there's a new administration in 2024, Netanyahu might get along more with them. And Netanyahu has not been averse to playing the American political game in the past if he thinks a presidential administration is going off the rails. And so if there's a sympathetic Congress, a Republican Congress that's maybe a little bit more pro-Israel, and the Biden administration is trying to play around, I wouldn't totally be shocked to see Netanyahu intervening in that piece of things as well. So a couple of things to watch, but mostly Israel is just fascinating if you're an election watcher, if you're interested in this kind of stuff at all. It is a really interesting country. There is a lot that is worth keeping your eyes on. And we will be following that election as it comes closer, trying to get more information. It's just, it's a fascinating system, it's a fascinating election, and if you're a political junkie at all, Israel is a country that is definitely worth watching. So that's going to be a wrap for this episode. Please remember that you can rate and subscribe on your favorite podcast provider. You can find us on all of the platforms mentioned at the beginning of this podcast. And once again, we thank American One for their support of these video podcasts and for releasing Blind Politics on their platform. Please check out their many other great podcast offerings. Whatever your interest, they probably have it or soon will. And once again, thank you for listening. And for Blind Politics, this is Dr. Nolte signing off.